Michael Jackson breaks bad, James Bond infiltrates the video game industry, and Rob Zombie ruins Halloween. This week on 30-2010.
2010.
Welcome all to 30-2010. I'm one of your hosts, Christopher Antista. Hi, who else is with us?
Pro ping pong player Dave Rudden.
Your butt is mine, Diana Goodman.
Oh my goodness. We have so many bad games and bad movies and bad television shows to talk about this week. But some notable highlights that we rattled off in the beginning, if you can guess what those are.
Bad music.
Some really bad music. What is it about this month? It's getting bad. Is this the...
Well, I mean, games are ramping up. We're at the end of the movie, the summer movie season, so those they're not going to be as good.
Yeah.
We're right on the precipice of a new fall season, so networks are just kind of phoning it in. But games are starting to pick up because... Especially in 2007, but also 1997, like this is when you start to build up towards the holiday season and all the big games.
And I also have to rattle off what the show is in case you've never listened to it before. 30-2010, we are a look back 30, 20, and 10 years ago to this very week. This week being August 25th through the 31st. So this week in 1997 and 2007. Man, it is. But just, I'm astounded by how bad the movies have gotten. If you thought Garbage Pail Kids was as bad as it could get, you are so wrong. Because I watched one of the movies for one of our segments, and it was. I haven't been this mad since I feel like I went full adult. So I can't wait to talk about that. But we have to get to some other stuff first. You like Laser Time shows? Then you might like Bonus Time, Laser Time's weekly bonus show exclusively on patreon.com/lasertime. Here's a taste of what you've been missing.
And so I was camping a lot of the weekend. We had a couple friends like drop out in like the last week. So it ended up being us and then like three couples that had two kids each. Actually, the craziest thing that happened is that we saw a kid choke.
Yeah.
Well, he was like... maybe three or four.
Oh, man.
And he walks up to the table. He starts by, like, belching, and we all laugh because it's like, that's funny. A little kid belched.
Yeah, a little kid burping.
And after about 2 seconds, I hear, like, yelling. The kid is starting to turn purple.
Oh, my God.
He's, like, in between two parents. One is putting their finger in his throat, and the other is slapping his back.
Whoa.
And...
is your brain like, oh, my God, I don't want to be on this trip.
Yes, like, this would be very bad. A four-year-old child dying...
right in front of you.
And what was supposed to be a fun camping trip. It's like a Rescue 911 episode.
Your brain's like, oh, I'm going to have to talk about this on Bonus Time.
No.
No.
He either swallowed it. I think he also, like, he might have thrown it up or whatever.
Yeah.
But so it was gone and, like, so it's so weird how kids' brains function. Like, he was hysterical crying for about 8 seconds. And then he's like, oh, my Peppa Pig toy.
Like, just puts it right back
and then and then he's, yeah, well, and, but then he's just like, oh, business as usual.
Get Bonus Time, Laser Time's weekly, full-length, uncensored, and ad-free Patreon-exclusive podcast, as well as full-length movie commentaries, wrestling and cartoon video commentaries, the first season of Talking Simpson, and more at patreon.com/lasertime, starting at just $5. You'll help us live, and we'll do our best to help you never be bored again. As always, starting with 1987, August 5th through the 31st. Don't see any notable news there.
We're saving all the news for 97.
Yeah.
Saving it all for 97. Stakeout, a movie everyone remembers, is number one at the box office. Actually, you went to bat for that, didn't you, Dean?
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, Babette's Feast.
So this is the movie you watched, right? Babette's
no.
Feast, the Danish adaptation of the Isaac Dinesen story.
Just from that description, I can't imagine being that mad at a movie like that. But you said it's the first Danish film to win the foreign language Oscar.
It is, yeah.
Mm.
So. Denmark.
End of the Line with Kevin Bacon, Wilford Brimley, Human Walrus, and Mary Steenburgen and Holly Hunter.
Wow, that's got to be a key cog in 6 Degrees of Separation for Kevin Bacon.
That is a good one. Yeah. I wish I'd heard of it. I mean, I watched the trailer. It's really goofy because it's about like the southern town that, you know, has always got the train running through it, and that they're gonna take the train away. Oh. And so Wilford Brimley is gonna go to the big city, and he's gonna tell him, "You can't take my train away."
Sure, this train is part of our heritage.
And Kevin Bacon's like, "I need that train to dance."
Yeah, and he just wanders around like with a t-shirt with the sleeves cut off, going like,
"Wow, Wilford Brimley."
Yep.
Wow. Unless
Kevin Bacon.
Oh, okay,
does.
Good.
Yeah, and he's like. Hey, Wilford Brimley, I want to date your daughter. I'm going to put on a crazy big accent.
Man, it's a lot of movies released, none of which are very interesting. My Little Girl with Mary Stuart Masterton and James Earl Jones. I can't imagine in my brain what that movie is, just by the title and the stars.
It's a privileged white girl goes to the big city and
talks to Darth Vader.
Yeah, pretty much. No, I mean, it's like a Dangerous Minds, but instead of her reaching the kids, it's more about, you know, her realizing, like, I've been too protected and there's bad things in the world and I'm going to grow up and deal with them.
Matawan with Chris Cooper and David Tratham and also James Earl Jones.
Meet One. This is the movie I will go to bat for out of this segment. Mm. This John Sayles joint. It's about...
John Sayles, good man.
Yeah, it's about miners in the 20s, like coal miners trying to form a union. Mm. It's like Chris Cooper's first role. David Strathairn is always awesome. It's a really, really good movie. I know that premise sounds super fucking boring. But no, it's a really good, heartfelt, family kind of character movie. Yeah, I love John Sayles.
And this movie has always fascinated me. Let's see if we can get an indication of what it is.
At its worst, fought by young men at their best. Hamburger Hill. 600 men went up. Less than a third came down.
Hamburger Hill. A movie I'm guessing you've seen, Diana.
Like a million years ago.
So, I remember this movie is notable for me because if you bought a DVD player in the first 2 years of their release and you wanted a movie that was less than $6, you had Hamburger Hill. So all of my friends had this movie in their collection because otherwise you'd have to pay $20-$30.
It cost less than a hamburger.
It cost less than a hearty $6 burger at the time, which I can't believe they're still calling it when it's $9. But everybody, I don't know anybody who's seen this, but all of my friends had it in their collection because it was an obtainable movie. It's like the Solar Jetman of your DVD collection. Don't know much else about it, sadly.
Which war is that?
I know. I thought it was World War II, but it looks like Vietnam.
It's Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
The whole time. I know I had it, too.
Yeah, well, look, we've covered a bunch of these already, including Full Metal Jacket. The late 80s, we had this run of Vietnam movies of, we're going to actually deal with this,
Let's finally talk about Vietnam.
Let's finally talk about Vietnam.
The dirty bearded guy outside your bagel place, he's got a story to tell, and Hollywood's going to tell it this year.
Yeah, it turns out it sucked. Mm-hmm. It sucked for a lot of different reasons, and some of the soldiers didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is based on a true story of this incredible, horrible battle to get this hill for probably no goddamn reason. Dermot Mulroney's first... No, Dylan McDermott's first movie. I did it.
Happens to everybody.
I did it. Courtney B. Vance. I think Don Cheadle's in there. Baby Don Cheadle. Mm-hmm. And... I remember thinking it was pretty good, and looking back on reviews, a lot of them said it is really well done. The battle feeling, you know, that it feels very realistic.
Well, good for you, Hamburger Hill. Diana remembers you.
Yeah, I'm the only one.
But here's part of a horror tetralogy I've been meaning to check out for a long time.
This trailer's
great. Sequel to House.
Last year, audiences everywhere thrilled to a terrifying film about the horrors of home ownership. House. Now, there's an all-new house.
Looks like you got some kind of alternate universe in there or something.
With Brad.
Hey, you recognize Cliff Clavin? You're putting out a new house? This also has a bizarre appearance by Bill Maher in a strangely decent acting performance. But House 2, what a great subtitle, colon the second story.
That's great.
House is a movie, I think Fred Decker, sent me a copy of Night of the Creeps and
is
Monster Squad.
Is it based off of the Japanese house?
No.
Okay, but
that's a good movie.
But
that's a crazy movie.
It does turn a house into Freddy Krueger. And it has some of the coolest looking puppet effects and match shots I've ever seen. Both 1 and 2 are available on YouTube for free. Standard definition-y, but unaltered and watchable. I've been meaning to check these out. I've always wanted to see House.
Like,
it has a great box cover.
You don't get to see the commercial breaks from Gilbert Gottfried. House is coming back right after these commercials for Duckman. Bye-bye.
It's too early to make a Hugh Laurie reference. But yeah, House 2, and then just the most... Like, if I still had downloaded porn on my computer and shared it with my parents, this is what I'd title my porn folder. The Fourth Protocol, starring Michael Caine and Pierce Brosnan, because it's guaranteed no one will click on it. Even I hesitate to play the trailer.
The Fourth Protocol. It stands between East and West, between trust and fear, between peace and war.
As a detonator for a bomb.
Bomb. An atomic bomb. On August 28th, the Fourth Protocol will be broken. Michael Caine, Pierce Brosnan, the countdown to terror has begun. The Fourth Protocol.
That's Man. Three times they said the name in the
first. Pierce acting very Bondy, though he won't be Bond for another like 5 or 6 years.
But not at all conflict with the Russian, irrelevant conflict with the Russians.
Yeah, I believe he's a Russian spy in this. Oh, no.
Oh, goodness.
So it sounds like we just need to send Michael Caine to visit Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump.
Why don't you put those away?
Come on, Mr. Trump. You just go on Twitter. Don't worry.
Some people just want to watch South Korea burn. That's probably not that's not very sensitive, but let's move it on into TV, because that was a ton of... Wow, we got through those movies real quick.
Yeah, and TV
none
is...
of them are really standout, except for Mate 1, like I said.
I would like to see House 2. That is the one I would like to eventually check out, because there's a bad horror movie I have to talk about later that really put a bad taste in my mouth this close to Halloween. Spoiler.
Hint.
TV is similarly slim this week, but on August 27th, 1987, the Family Ties spinoff The Art of Being Nick airs.
Oh, no.
This was the third attempt that the producers made to spin off the character of Nick Moore, who was Mallory's boyfriend.
The third attempt for that character?
Yeah, so what? I thought, like, this is like the same level of Joey Tribbiani on Married with Children. He got, like,
he got
three,
two shots.
Yeah, he got a bunch of spinoff attempts. This one was the only one, I think, that made it to, like, actual airing.
Yeah.
Like, the first one, I think it was supposed to be him taking care of his grandfather, and the guy who played his grandfather died before they could record it, so they're like, well, aww, let's try that again sometime later. They finally made this one, and it actually did pretty well, but they decided to just keep Nick on Family Ties, because everyone loved the character so much.
I don't even remember him.
Yeah.
I don't either, and he's not even in the clip that I captured, because this is a future sitcom star who is on this show, and probably did good by not getting picked up, because within 2 years she'd be on a sitcom that everyone remembers.
Rachel, you must feel terrible.
Oh, no, no.
Let me tell Nick to come back later.
Oh, no, 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 no. I'm all right. I'm not letting this get to me. I mean, breaking up with Brad is just another experience, right? And you know me, I absolutely crave experience.
Wow, is Elaine picking up on there? Yes. Because like the grainy video quality pulled up on YouTube. But she has Elaine's haircut, haircut
she
as well.
Just like her. Hey, but you didn't get to finish. She didn't get to finish her joke.
I want to experience pleasure. I want to experience pain. But I want it to be Brad's pain.
Oh, Julia, you'll win every Emmy. Jesus Christ, yeah. Good thing she didn't end up going with that.
Because, this is, like, post-SNL, but just within a year or two, like, she'd get the pilot for Seinfeld, and then that would eventually roll into Seinfeld proper.
And I love that we get to talk about this, because this is something I'm not sure any artist had done before or will ever do again.
We'll get into this more in music, but, on August 31st, 1987, CBS aired the special Michael Jackson, The Magic Returns, which featured the debut of the music video Bad from Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, starring Wesley Snipes.
Well, you forget, you probably wouldn't forget, but, like, a lot of Michael Jackson's early music videos are 20 minutes long.
Yeah.
So that's, like, you couldn't... I mean, it would air on MTV, but it's like, the proper way to introduce it is to have a special, because this will be one third of the special.
Yeah, I don't know anybody who could release a song, make a short film out of it, and then interrupt network programming in a three-channel universe.
Yeah.
I don't know if that Elvis did that.
I don't know. I mean,
I don't know that Lady Gaga could do that.
This was deserving of being on prime time, but it's also August 31st, so like every channel is a week or two away from debuting new TV shows. So it's like, why not put Michael Jackson on at 8 o'clock?
Let's fill up some time.
Totally, but even I remember growing up in the Simpsons era of like that black or white album would preempt the fucking Simpsons to show you a Michael Jackson Vanity Project. It was insane. Yeah. I think at some point it ended up running on every single network simultaneously. That's how big it was, like a presidential speech. What I meant to look up and forgot is I'm like, Martin Scorsese, can you talk about this experience?
Yeah.
And was this just a money thing, or is there something you and Michael Jackson got along about? If he's like this,
I mean, this was after like Vincent Price and Thriller.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Like, maybe just like, hey, this is Scorsese the thing that the directors do for vanity now is they directed Michael Jackson.
Yeah, but Scorsese is not John Landis. John Landis, directed a werewolf movie. Yeah. Essentially, he loves werewolves. He made a great werewolf movie. But Scorsese,
that is about crime.
Apparently, they did not get along very well.
They don't seem like a good fit to me at all. Because I know Michael Jackson loves movies, but they all star Disney children. But holy shit,
yeah,
this is great.
Speaking of bad, on August 28th, 1987, Castlevania II: Simon's Quest released in Japan. It won't release in America for like another year and a half. But seeing as how that game is equally incomprehensible in Japan, in Japanese and English, I thought I'd just bring it up now. But I included a commercial which tries to sell it as a fun game, but it's not.
You left him for dead in Konami's Castlevania. How foolish to presume he'd perish without leaving a curse. For now, in Simon's Quest for Nintendo, fate stalks your very being, and you need more than clues from cowardly villagers to survive when day turns into night. But just keep telling yourself it's only a video game. It's only a...
Oh, I love Konami. I this was my introduction.
Did they have to kick over some money for ripping off Last House on the Left there?
Yeah. Into the Vincent Price estate for mimicking his VO. But this was my introduction to Castlevania, so I didn't get away. And I love, we talk about that all the time, a fascinating period, Diana, in video games where like, in just sequels, like the companies assumed we're trying to sell this video game forever. So if we release another one, it can't be anything like the first.
Yeah.
And this went from a straightforward kind of side scroller with bosses and some weapon pickups and power ups to like a day night cycle confusing. Like I just wandered around
kind
in
of
the
like
game.
Like an open world where you don't know where to go exactly. You get these vague clues. Half the people are lying to you. Like just confusing as hell. You needed a strategy guide back then to do anything,
because there's
game.
Something like you have to like ride a tornado at a certain time of day.
You have to have a crystal in your hand and you kneel in front of this big brick wall, and then a tornado comes and blows you to the next.
I think there's a chance you can glean that from some of the dialogue, but not really.
It's
progress in the game.
It's all very vague and not very good. And like there's like,
but if you know what you're doing, it's a really fun
experience.
There's
like a fan hack that I think released somewhat recently where they were like, we fixed it so they actually say the things that they need to be
saying.
Because
what makes it so interesting to me, if you know what Castlevania would become after Symphony of the Night, the Metroidvania style, that essentially is here in Simon's Quest, Castlevania 2, and they walked it back after not knowing how to execute it very well. But a fascinating game, totally worth picking up if you're a huge Castlevania fan. Your guides are readily available for free.
I think it might be on the NES Classic.
It is on the NES Classic.
Okay. But they still
you're never going to get one of those.
Yeah, they still haven't fixed the...
You'll have to settle for
incomprehensibleness.
You'll have to settle for a free internet version until they make it available to you. But into music, Madonna's "Who's That Girl" is number one, and we have the release of "Bad" by Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
I think what album is this off of? Just "Bad."
Bad.
Bad.
Yeah, it's called
"Bad." New releases: "Door to Door" by The Cars, "Sentimental Hygiene" by Warren Zevon, "Darklands" by Jesus and Mary Chain, and two monster albums. Is that incredible albums? Aerosmith's "Comeback Permanent Vacation," which features Angel and Dude Looks Like a Lady, and sold 5 million copies in the U.S., and Michael Jackson's "Bad," which sold 35 million copies worldwide. It had five singles that hit number one, so we'll have to go out with one of them.
One of the few that didn't.
"Smooth Criminal" didn't?
No.
That's the most resilient song on the fucking album.
I know. Yeah. I know. A bunch of the ones that made it to number one are not ones that I remembered off the top of my head, but "Smooth Criminal" is just dead stuck
around
forever.
"Smooth Criminal" is
great.
It did make it to number seven, and it was the number one Alien Ant Farm song, in my opinion. So
let me ask you this. I'm going to take it to a group vote. You want to close out with the original or a remix that I made, custom made, when Michael Jackson died, involving the Genesis Moonwalker music, where he sings over the Moonwalker music? It's exclusive to us.
Well, obviously, we have to.
Oh, sweet. Well, stay tuned, everybody. We will be right back with 1997, August 25th through the 31st.
Ahoy hoy, everybody. This is Bob Mackey.
Chris Antista.
Henry Gilbert.
And when you're done listening to this, we'd like you to check out Talking Simpsons. It's our chronological exploration of The Simpsons only on the Laser Time Podcast Network.
Where we occasionally talk sports.
Daryl.
When we throw people under the bus, name names like the insidious
Mr. Black.
And we're the one podcast that will never sell out to foreign interests.
Ooh, the Germans are mad at me. I'm so scared. Ooh, the Germans.
Stop. For all this and more, listen to Talking Simpsons every Wednesday at TalkingSimpsons.com or wherever you find your podcasts.
Du, du hast mich.
That is, of course, Du hast by Rammstein.
Rammstein.
I don't know a lot of other songs, but I hated this at the time, but man, it's really grown on me as a just a really fun, evocative of the era song.
One of the few, like, completely foreign language.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, songs that, like, hit it big on MTV and all that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I should have looked up what Du hast means.
I'm guessing. It's like, you must.
You must?
Yeah.
All right. That's by Rammstein off the album Schesschucht. Is saying that right? Along with Radiator by Super Furry Animals, Word Gets Around by Stereophonics, Evolution by Martina McBride, Moby's I Like to Score, a compilation remix from Movies, Making Friends by No Use for a Name, Love Scenes by Diana Krall, and Creed's debut, My Own Prison, and My Soul by Coolio. And of course, I'll Be Missing You is still number one and will remain that way for a while.
For the rest of our lives.
Yeah, Jesus Christ. Creed, I should be able to talk more about Creed. This is dumb. But, like, my friend's brother managed them. Like, it was bizarre. They became a Tallahassee staple. Like, they'd play every weekend. The radio station would invite everybody out. Huge crowds. My friend's band opened for them. They were even worse. It was a big thing. It was like Tallahassee's first big band, and then Creed hit it big, got a major label debut. My Own Prison has two music videos, mm-hmm. one that was filmed in the era where they were like a Tallahassee band, and one that was made when they signed onto a major label, and they're both fucking hilarious. Creed was a really huge deal, and as a further fuck you, they got big, got signed, and like according to their bio, yeah, we're from Orlando. They were in college at Florida State University. Tallahassee built them. They never came back and performed again, ever. Like, I don't think they performed in Orlando every week. I know they didn't perform every week like they did in Tallahassee.
Oh, and so, like, how could they?
As a result, if you hate Scott Stapp, come back with me to my hometown of Tallahassee. And there's a ton of stories of people who worked with him and knew him, and they don't like him either. Apparently stole a lot of food from the restaurants he worked in. 1997, the news that we missed this last week. The Lilith Fair tour ended.
Yeah, the end of the first Lilith Fair tour, mm-hmm. which... Hmm. Looking at the lineup, I mean, I remember it's like such an easy joke of like, oh, wow, is this some sort of like lesbian party or something? Where it's like, yeah, it's a
well,
music.
That fourth week must be rough.
Yes, yeah. And it's awesome.
But it's like, you know, it's a music festival with just women artists. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, that sounds so like touchy-feely and boring. And yeah, like we're all going to put flowers in our hair and then menstruate on each other or something. But then I look at the lineup, I'm like, holy shit, this was a really good lineup.
You could have caught a dozen stellar music acts that would have cost you hundreds of dollars just by attending. I always attend festivals like this. This just never came close to me. I would have gone.
I didn't realize, it's multiple stages and mm-hmm. different size acts and it tours everywhere. And I mean, like, main stage lineup, Sarah McLachlan, Sheryl mm-hmm. Crow, Tracy Chapman, Jewel, Paula Cole, Suzanne Vega, Emmylou Harris, Lisa Loeb, yeah. India Ari. That's something for literally everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
That's something for everybody.
It only seems bizarre just by how, like, this covers, like, so many fucking genres. You can't really be fans of all this, but that's kind of neat.
Yeah, it's sort of almost like the point. It's like, no, we have lots of kinds of music because women make lots of kinds of music. Yeah. You can have a little bit of everything.
Yeah. I was just wondering with my girlfriend if they were still doing this, and if not, why? Because it seems like they revived it in 2010, mm-hmm. But after that... And it raised money for charity as well.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know why it's not still going on. I guess, was it the Indigo Girls who kind of ushered the thing into existence?
Them and Sarah McLachlan, yeah. It was sort of their baby.
Well, R.I.P. Lilith Fair, and speaking of resting in peace, Jesus Christ.
Ooh, all right.
Holy
so...
shit, I'm older than Princess Di.
Yep. Yep, you are.
August 31st, 1997, someone who had lived their life like a candle in the wind and who always went down to the Crocodile Rock, Princess Diana. I do remember this being... I don't know. You can explain it.
What's there to explain? I mean, it's one of those... it's, I mean, you can't say, oh, it's like the Kennedy assassination. Oh, mm-hmm. it's like 9/11. Mm-hmm. But it was, it felt like everything freaking stopped. Yeah. And this was all anyone talked about for a week.
Yeah. I remember it being the summer and I was off doing teenage things. But anytime you got close to a radio or television, nothing else was being talked about.
I mean, I do remember like breaking in on, mm-hmm. I was watching a rerun of Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
And then this like came out and was yeah. like, well, I'm going to be up for a few more hours, I guess.
And what was it? Her and her boyfriend Go pursued by paparazzi
right.
And then ended up in a car accident. Just a really vile, tragic thing that
that she was being, you know, chased down by paparazzi. And that's kind of how she had lived her life.
Yeah.
And, you know, after she
also like a candle in the wind,
she gets a divorce and she seems like things are going pretty well for mm-hmm. her. And yeah, she's only 36.
Wow.
And yeah, and then it just and then it's like this shock of like, wait, what the fuck just happened? And yeah. wait, did the paparazzi just kill somebody?
Are they culpable for this death? Did it change laws about how the press were allowed to pursue public figures? I have to imagine it did.
I mean, some of it was, I mean, the driver of her car had been drinking.
Mm-hmm.
He was killed in the accident. I mean, she and Dodi Fayed in the backseat weren't wearing seatbelts. That's
Jesus Christ.
Never a good thing. But yeah, this
you're in
was,
a limo. I mean, it's kind of like
yeah. You think you're.
They were in a limo.
Well, no, they were in like a sedan car. But
because I still vaguely remember footage of it, even though I didn't care and wasn't paying attention.
Yeah.
But it was everywhere. I was a narcissistic little teenager.
Yeah. But then it was so weird because like it started this whole big conversation about paparazzi and how they were chasing her and all that. But also you've got like the 24-hour news channels and like all the news channels. They need to illustrate it with something. So they keep running this, like, paparazzi footage.
Yeah.
And, you know, the footage of her.
It's part of the problem.
Like, yes. She and her kids are skiing, and they're following her, and she, like, walks over to them and is like, hey, guys, come on. Like, could you just let my kids have a vacation, and I'll talk to you later? It's like, well, you're paying for that footage while you're condemning it, you dicks.
Yeah, it's like, we'll be right back with this Yul Brynner tribute after this word from Winston Cigarettes. What the fuck? I guess we want to move...
No, there's one thing I do want to mention, though.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think, like, the outpouring of emotion from the British people was, mm-hmm. like, a big surprise. Like, we're thinking of, like, keep calm and carry on, and then to see them, like, the piles of flowers, like, 8 feet high in front of freaking Kensington Palace.
Just out of curiosity, growing up as someone named Diana... During all this, even I, like I say, die. It took me a long time not to associate it with Princess Diana.
Yeah, it was weird. Like considering that she was always on the covers of every mm-hmm. fucking magazine, people just, you know, I would like to cut out like the headlines as like Queen says Diana demon from hell.
And that's a messy thing that maybe we'll get into in a future episode of 302010, a high-profile royal divorce.
Oh, yeah.
And then she ends up becoming more beloved than
the
actual
because,
royalty.
You know, we heard all this stuff coming out later about how bad the marriage was and how, you know, people felt bad. It's like she was raised as a comparatively normal person and then you get stuck in this weird aquarium where, like, you have to curtsy to your mother-in-law and, like, you're trading in your privacy and private life for like outstanding luxury.
Yeah.
And it's like, but don't you deserve some sort of privacy? You know, it should not be taking like upskirt photos of you when you're like changing at the gym, you know? So anyway, but you know what was weird is people always misspelled my name, even though Princess Diana was so famous. They always misspelled my name until around this time.
How? There's like not a wasted letter in your name.
They put in a double N or it's Diane with an E. And then after this, just because it was so fucking constant, no one got it wrong after that. I was always, they finally got it right.
Well, segueing into the movies of 1997, August 25th through the 31st, G.I. Jane is, of course, number one, but I think only for 1 week. But it's not like she has a bunch of stiff competition, Demi Moore, because a bunch of largely forgettable movies. I wanted to play this one real fast. It made me laugh a lot because we just did an episode of Laser Time. Diana joined us for it about stupid forms of censorship.
That was
and
great.
This has the greatest 90 music misdirect of all time from one of the songs we talked about that was censored all over the place during 1997. And it is an abrupt, it is so stupid and abrupt. You think you're about to hear a song and then it goes into something wildly more 1997.
Boy steals car. Boy finds girl.
Are you mental?
So that's Benicio del Toro and Alicia Silverstone with an intro from Third Eye Blind runs into the Spice Girls.
But I don't think people knew that song well enough that they'd be like, oh, here it comes. It was just like someone who's like, I like the beginning of this song.
But someone who loves that song, when I watch this, I'm like, oh, yeah, here we go. What the fuck? You just pulled the rug out from under me.
Also, so weird to see Alicia Silverstone and Benicio del Toro. And are they supposed to be somewhat romantic in this?
Yes.
I think this is
weird.
Following up on like that Tarantino era of crime comedy. So I looked up the screenwriter, and I think this is like his sole credit. But desperate for that kind of thing. Because
I love you, Alicia Silverstone. What the fuck?
Alicia Silverstone. What the fuck?
Yeah, so Excess Baggage. Do we even say the name?
Excess Baggage.
She's a spoiled rich girl
who fakes her own kidnapping, but then Benicio del Toro, give me a fucking keys, it like finds her, and they end up kind of falling. He steals her car, ends up finding her kind of culpable for kidnapping, and they end up forming a
Excess
relationship.
Excess Baggage sounds like it could be 8 different movies.
Exactly. Yeah. It's fucking stupid.
It's so weird, though. I haven't seen this. I only watched the trailer. And just, the idea of we're trying to sell Benicio del Toro as, like, an average leading man.
It's,
where he's got kind of, like, frosted tips almost, and he's like, I'm a normal guy, not a weird character actor.
I had only seen him at this point in Usual Suspects as the unintelligible Finster who I constantly do impressions of. The pictures from this movie, he's smoking. He's a good-looking dude. Like, a young Benicio del Toro in a leading hunky role. It's a really weird... They're really weird images to look at. Because who doesn't love Benicio del Toro? Even less notable, Hoodlum, with Lawrence Fishburne, Tim Roth, and Vanessa Williams.
Also Andy Garcia. City ruled by organized crime. America's most dangerous men began a war about power, about money, a war of will between legends.
Okay, a nice little fedora period piece about old-timey gangsters.
Yeah, but I'm sort of interested in this because, like, I feel like I've seen there's so many, you know, real-life gangsters. This is a study, you know, Lucky Luciano and Dutch Schultz, but this one's got Lawrence Fishburne as this black gangster who does not get covered, and that makes me
a real person. Oh, okay. And that's what makes this fascinating. If you follow the cast around, Lawrence Fishburne is playing Ellsworth Bumpy Johnson,
This
is technically his second time playing that same character.
Really?
Because he played the same character in 1984's The Cotton Club in a brief sequence. Clarence Williams III, who is also in the movie, he plays the rival to Lawrence Fishburne. He played him 10 years later in American Gangster, the same character.
Oh, my God.
Ellsworth Bumpy Johnson. So three movies.
You said Bumpy Johnson.
Three movies with connections, with deep connections to two actors. Pretty weird. It makes me feel like, do we not have enough old-timey black gangsters? There's just one.
I'm sure there's more. We should spread out to some. It's interesting. It's pretty interesting. Also, I didn't realize it's directed by Bill Duke.
Bill Duke.
Of Predator?
Of Predator.
Wow.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Okay, and
I didn't know he directed.
Yeah, crazy.
Know, that's cool.
Even less notable...
Eddie.
For whatever reason, she belongs to me.
Joey. They have nothing in common except the one person in the world.
She's my wife. You just forget about her.
Neither of them can live without.
Get your coat, Marie. I'm getting out of here.
Make up your mind, babe. I want you to stay. He wants you to go.
Sean Penn, Robin Wright Penn, and John Travolta. She's so lovely.
She's so lovely. What a terrible title.
Well, they had to change it. It was supposed to be She's DeLovely, which is a Cole Porter song, they wouldn't let him which is an even worse title. The only thing interesting about this is directed by Nick Cassavetes.
Yes. Written by John Cassavetes?
Written by his father, John Cassavetes. It was a project that he never got off the ground.
Yeah, he couldn't get off the ground. I went looking at Nick Cassavetes' bio, like, this is the only time he did that. Like, worked on something his father did, and he's kind of he's uncredited for the obvious rewrite of a movie that's made 10 years later. Pretty neat. Son directing his dead father's script. That's pretty neat.
It's weird seeing Sean Penn do a movie that isn't like blatant Oscar bait.
Sort of
like a cute indie. It's totally like a post-Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, everyone's a hitman.
It's cute.
It's only Robin Wright Penn, as she's credited, looks exactly the fucking same.
She does.
Exactly the fucking same as she does right now in House of Cards and Wonder Woman. I guess that's
notable. Her secret. Have I told you my story about seeing her?
No.
Back when I lived up in Marin, I was at a Rite Aid once when she was with Sean Penn. They also live up in Marin. So I was at a Rite Aid, and this lady walks in with her little girl, and she's wearing this really cute, like, red crochet hat. that was kind of like a love story sort of hat, and I thought it was really cute, and I was like looking at it like, oh, that's a really cute hat. And I, there was a moment where I realized, oh, I'm kind of looking a little long, and I looked down at her face and realized, oh shit, that's Robin Wright.
Did you say hi?
And she just sort of looked at me and sort of smiled and nodded like, yeah, it's me, it's Robin Wright. And I was like, no, I was looking at your hat. I really want to be like, cute hat. And just let her know, I'm not staring at you because you're a famous person. I really was just looking at your hat.
Oh, man.
I felt like such a dick.
I mean, I don't mind extending the conversation on this because this movie looks fucking terrible.
Oh, God.
1997's Kevin Sorbo starring, sidekicked by Tia
Carrere. How was this a movie in theaters and not a movie on the WB?
Yeah, Cull the Conqueror.
Yeah.
He was a warrior slave until fate made him king.
Long live Cull!
All slaves of Illusia are now free.
Yes, Cull the Conqueror. Never heard of it. I mean, I definitely heard of it, but I, even at the time, like, who wants to see this shit? And I was just looking at, well, what has the director done primarily? He's still known, John Nicola, known primarily for Miami Vice and a longtime partnership with Don Johnson, including directing his Heartbeats video.
Oh, no, that's awful.
Yeah, and on and into Nash Bridges as well. Like, okay. Longtime Don Johnson partnership. Somehow directed this movie out of nowhere. Cull the Conqueror. Was Kevin Sorbo ever really that hot? He needed...
Yeah,
I mean, I guess he is off
hot.
Of Hercules at this point. So he's familiar, but he's still not like a household name.
Why not make a more expensive Hercules movie? Because Jesus Christ, does that show not hold up well in the effects department?
But man, like the fantasy genre was pretty dead around this point, and to give it a try with something that's basically a Conan story,
a barbarian movie.
But it's I think it's adapted from a story that's a Conan story.
Oh no shit.
Yeah, the only nice thing I have to say is watching a couple versions of the trailer, trying to find a clip.
Yeah, it's adapted from Robert E. Howard's source material.
Yeah, the best thing about it seems to be Tia Carrere is like evil witch queen, and she looks like she knows what she's doing. She knows what kind of movie she's in. She's like, you must kill him. Man, I will destroy you, Cull.
I mean, like, Tia Carrere is one of my first giant crushes around the time I was actually entering in puberty. She's a very special person to me. What's she up to now? Talk to us, Tia Carrere. We can move on to the TV, Diamond Dog.
Again, a bit of a sparse week. Yeah. We have
not from those upstart networks.
Yes. Well, yeah. So a bunch of WB shows debut. There's one show called Good News, which is about a preacher in Compton. This is also the WB's first spinoff, because this was a spinoff of Sparks, which was like
what
one of the
fuck is Sparks?
Sparks is one of the WB's first shows. Don't ask me what that's about, because I didn't bother to find out. There's also Head Over Heels, which is about a pair of brothers running a video dating service. This is 1997, mind you. I think that idea for a show would be outdated like in 2 years.
It's such a bummer that unlike the internet where you can delete your dating profile, some of those videos have lasted forever.
Yes.
And whenever they're posted online, I can't not watch some desperate dude with a thin mustache smoking a cigarette talking about the kind of lady he wants.
But the most notable new WB show that debuted this week, at least to me, is Hits, which has Andrew Dice Clay as the star. He plays a record executive. And I hope this is a little bit long, but you should play the whole clip because it is so 1997.
Sure. Tell me when to stop.
For he's a jolly good fellow, which nobody can deny.
Is that real good, Chris?
Hold on.
That was beautiful, fellas.
This is exactly what I'm talking about. You get an important band like Real Big Fish to come in and feed your ego? How much did this cost us?
You shut up. It didn't cost a dime. Here are those pictures.
We all there?
Every last one of them.
What about the negatives?
And what about them?
This is the last time we go on vacation with Brad Pitt.
You're despicable.
Despicable, yes. But a jolly good fellow.
Hey! Smoking cigarettes. Misogyny,
Real Big Fish, what about my real big dick? Hey!
I'm gonna wear a silver shirt and it's gonna be buttoned all the way up.
So when the world ends and you tell your friends about 30-2010, you make sure to remember we introduced you to a clip of Andrew Dice Clay blackmailing Real Big Fish.
Yes.
We did
on a WB sitcom.
We did that.
That spoiler lasted one season. All of these shows lasted one season. So,
but something that also lasted... a finale. Did this move over to the WB?
I don't think it did.
Okay.
But yeah, so way more successful than all those other shows was Hanging with Mr. Cooper, which was one of, it was a TGIF show for a while. It lasted 5 seasons and broke the syndication barrier with 101 episodes.
Good for them. Was it syndicated? Probably not.
Probably. Not very widely. Maybe on TBS for like one summer.
Somewhere on like Uzbekistani Channel 92, sure.
Or Laugh, or like one of those stations that they pull in over a satellite or pull in over an antenna. But I put the theme in there because I like this show.
No, I totally liked the name of Mr. Cooper.
I was a TGIF kid, so I remember this.
Hey, yo, what's up?
It's about a basketball player who goes to live with, I think, his sister and take care of kids and all that.
Mm-hmm. And I more so than like many other actors, people refer to Mark Curry as Mr. Cooper as this character's name because of whatever impression it made.
I don't know why they couldn't have just called it Hanging with Mr. Curry.
For real, why not? Or just change your name to Mark Cooper.
Yeah. But also, Mark Curry, so I really liked him on the show. Never really saw him go anywhere else afterwards.
Comedy Central's Don't Forget Your Toothbrush?
Really?
Yes.
What is... I know that
was,
name.
It was a game show he hosted. I thought it was funny, but that it was designed around... If you're in the audience, you can have a chance of being pulled out of the audience to go win prizes and trips. But don't forget your toothbrush, because when you win, you are whisked away on your trip immediately.
But you know, anywhere anywhere you go on vacation, you can buy a new toothbrush.
That's true. There. That's true. Yeah. But it's based, if it wasn't obvious, it's based on like an English game show. Yeah. And it's just the most British title in the universe. Yep. Don't forget your toothbrush. But that it is over. Hanging with Mr. Cooper is over. Will it ever get a proper DVD release? Sign my petition and find out.
I don't know. You got to get En Vogue to sign off on that music there.
Was that En Vogue?
I think it was.
Hanging with Mr. Cooper. But yeah, I was a TGIF addict, and I regret every second of it. None of that shit holds up. I don't know. It's what do we call that? Unworthy nostalgia?
Man.
Yeah.
But not like this.
Well, I've got some Perfect Strangers episodes to show you.
Can I say something?
Please, Dee.
I want to start talking about games, please.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I can talk about a video game.
This is great. This is great because
This is a game I played.
Most successful games ever made, I believe. Yep. But here's a commercial for
it.
Bond. James Bond is blasting his way onto Nintendo 64 in the game version of the hit feature film, GoldenEye. Read your case file, grab your gun and clever gadgets, then control the actions of 007, the world's most famous spy. True 3D movement, motion and character showcase the game's amazing realism. Different weapons allow you to accomplish your task covertly or not. Play solo or against a friend or foe with a two-character split screen. Good luck, Bond!
Play his odd job. It's totally cheating.
I thought it was important to play all of that because all of those were features that are standards of the first-person shooter genre that GoldenEye helped usher in to the world of consoles. Mm-hmm. I will solely attribute first-person. That's all mostly what games are now because of GoldenEye. It's such a weird partnership. A Nintendo 64 exclusive made by their second-party studio, Rare. Mm-hmm. It was delayed forever. The movie's a year old at this point.
Two years old
at this point. But it sold so many copies. This was so ubiquitous in culture that Diane, how are you familiar with the game?
I just played a fuck ton of this. First of all, I love GoldenEye, the movie. Loved it. And this was simple enough. The NES controllers were simple enough that I could do them. Anything with two joysticks, I can't do. Yeah, I can't do two thumbsticks.
My dad could never master the mouse and keyboard first-person shooter control scheme, but I saw a bunch of people pick this up, and for some fucking reason, the Nintendo 64 battering controller, using the yellow CC button, camera movement buttons to strafe, people were able to adapt to it. I'm still shocked by that.
Yeah, I can do it. And, you know, I understood that the maps aren't too complicated. They're just complicated enough that, like, with repetition, I would know where I'm going, what I'm doing. Shooting is pretty easy, even not in big head mode. I hated big head mode. It's creepy to assassinate people in big head
mode. It's one of the greatest things about it is all the different modes, all the different characters. It was like before the licensing nightmare that James Bond would become, because there's a multiplayer mode where you can play as fucking everybody, including Connery.
Yeah.
Jaws, Oddjob. And like, it was a multiplayer feat. And was it last year or 2 years ago for our Patreon? Patreon.com/LaserTime. We do movie commentaries.
Yeah.
We did for GoldenEye. I had never, ever seen GoldenEye before.
Yeah,
and it was, I have no experience I can equate to this. putting the pieces together of how the game worked out. How many times I played the game with sequences in the film, like, oh, there's the satellite dish on the dam. They're going to the dam. I'd never seen this before. Well, Joe Don Baker's in this. Great.
It's pretty crazy that within 10 years, Pierce Brosnan went from being second build in some war movie that nobody remembers to being the star of the biggest video game on Nintendo 64.
Yeah, it became a giant. The game itself, it tells the story of GoldenEye, which I don't. It's not. You like it, but I think people consider it a lesser Bond film.
Yeah.
I think, and obviously, the legacy of this game has outlived that of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Or at least overshadowed
it. That is true.
But at its core, it is a giant celebration of Bond. You have the golden gun as a weapon in the game. You have the Moonraker laser as a weapon in the game. The Bond license has been notoriously changed hands several times since then to try and recapture the magic that GoldenEye did in this summer of 1997. And it hasn't really ever worked that well. This is, I don't know, this is
like one game that people keep asking to be like, they did a, EA kind of made a new GoldenEye game, but it wasn't what people wanted really. This is also not on Rare Replay, like the collection of Rare games, obviously, because there's a lot
James
of
Bond license.
A lot of licenses to deal with, but it's like, I think you just gotta get an N64 and play it the way it was originally made. You can't like
recapture this. Well, there are fan remakes and like the Half-Life engine, and people have remade it. But it's still charming. I think I love shooting endless guys' hats off, hiding in a bathroom, and shooting hundreds of people until they start to evaporate because the N64 can't handle it. If you were in a dorm room, you played this game.
Yes.
I love hearing like writers' rooms of my favorite shows. They were playing this game. If you were a child, you were playing this game. I think last I remember being brought up was Jimmy Fallon had Pierce Brosnan play it horribly on his show. But yeah, holy shit. I remember reading, and I was trying to find the stat off the top of my head. Somebody was talking about the booming industry of video games, and they got a hold of the production budget of GoldenEye 64 and how much it cost and how much it made as a $70 game. It was expensive for years. And it made around $4 billion. I thought they said $4 billion. So whatever its development budget was, as long as it wasn't that of Waterworld, it was one of the most profitable things ever made. Wow. This GoldenEye game.
Well, it was just. I remember it being so ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. Just it was the shooter that every single person had. If you had an N64. Whether or not you knew what the movie was, you ever saw it, you gave a shit about James Bond. It was the shooter. I beat this game.
Did you really?
Wow. Except for one thing.
What?
Oh, at the end, you got to chase John Bean and you got to put like 80 million rounds into him. And then he drops down onto this tiny little platform. Because of my lack of decent controls, I would always jump down onto the platform and fall off and die. But I feel like I did it like a week. I kept trying that level over and over and I could never, ever catch up with him. I decided, you know what? I'm going to count this as a win.
It's just.
I put 1,000 rounds into Sean Bean just because I missed that last jump. I'm going to count him as dead because he's Sean Bean and he always dies.
Yeah, he always dies.
Even in video games, he has to die.
Yes. Yeah. Over and over again. But yeah, man, that's GoldenEye. I don't even know if we have to say all this stuff. For some reason, this one James Bond movie has a game that's synonymous with the medium of video games itself. It's fucking crazy. And then the game is great. The single player is great. It tells the story of the film. You get a bunch of awesome gadgets. For the first time ever, you do feel like Bond. Proxy mines and watch weapons and all that horse shit. It's really cool. Really cool game.
Since I didn't have an N64 back then, I was playing some of the PS1 releases of this week. A bunch of new PS1 games out, including Felony 1179, which was like a mediocre racing game, but I did play it.
Canadian Punk Band?
Yes. Lost World Jurassic Park, which is a 2D platformer.
You stream that on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/lasertime. It's horrible.
Yes. Back then, it was a little less horrible. Still pretty horrible, though.
Yes.
Machine Hunter. NHL 98, Nuclear Strike, one of the final Strike games. Mm-hmm. I missed that series. Steel Rain, Treasures of the Deep, and Warcraft 2, The Dark Saga. All those came out on PS1 this week, but I think most people would rather just play GoldenEye.
Yeah, it's weird to see video games finally coming out consistently on these platforms that are now taking off. But to close out 1997, why don't we go out with the International Language of Screaming by Super Furry Animals off the album that came out this week. And we will see you in 2007. It's not where you're from. It's not where you're at. It's not where you've been. It's way up between. It's not what you feel. It's not what you see. It's way up between. We'll be right back.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Internet and all the ships at sea. It's time for Diana's Classic Corner. We look even further back in time this week to see if there's anything worth a watching. And for the week of August 25th, August 31st, yep, I got some recommendations, so hold on to your hats. 75 years ago this week, there's a movie called The Loves of Edgar Allan Poe with Linda Darnell. That is, like, the weirdest concept for a movie I've ever heard. I mean, Edgar Allan Poe is a miserable son of a bitch who married his younger cousin. I don't imagine him having multiple loves, that it's wonderful and sweet and whatever. I just thought I'd throw that out there. There's also the adaptation of Tortilla Flat, starring Spencer Tracy and Hedy Lamarr. Meh, I'm not going to recommend those, sorry. Then 50 years ago this week, 1967, we had a bunch of deaths. Brian Epstein, the first manager of the Beatles, passed away. He was only 32. Paul Muni was 71. He was in a bunch of great movies, especially in the 30s, like the ludicrously titled but still wonderful I Was a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. And topically enough, George Lincoln Rockwell died. He was 49. He was the founder of the American Nazi Party. And he was shot by one of his own guys. I didn't even know that. He was full-on assassinated by another Nazi who was pissed at him. So, you know, Richard Spencer, watch your back. The actual recommendation I'm going to make, though, is 1967, 50 years ago this week, Point Blank, starring Lee Marvin and Angie Dickinson, came out. This is such a fun movie. I can't even. Lee Marvin is, like, the manliest man ever. He's so much fun when he will not take shit from people. And this is Payback is basically a remake of this, where he's a criminal who is double-crossed, left for dead, and then he comes back and becomes a human tornado, just ripping through every single person who gets in his way so he can get some revenge. It's really watchable, real fun. Lee Marvin's just a badass, and total recommend for this week. If you don't like classic movies because you think they're boring, you'll probably really enjoy this. And that's it for this week. Stay classic.
Coming in with a bunch of words I'm going to read for the first time. Coffee Shop by Young Jock of Hustlenomics, featuring Gorilla Joe, released this week.
Yep.
But yeah, look at that. Super Furry Animals coming in again. Hey Venus releases this week, 10 years to the day of their previous, not their previous album. None Shall Pass by Aesop Rock, lead sales paper anchor by Atreyu. Lifeline by Ben Harper. Afterwords by Collective Soul. And Scary Kids, Scaring Kids, the eponymous final album of that band.
Yep.
Beautiful Girls by Sean Kingston is still numero uno. And man, I'm glad we don't have a lot of news to talk about in this segment, because I need to bitch about a movie real hard.
All right.
But moving right into the movies of 2007 from the week of August 25th through the 31st, this is nuts.
It's balls.
Welcome to my Tournament of Champions. I have assembled the most talented athletes from around the globe.
Sport of emperors and bandits alike.
Ping pong. Or, as the Chinese say, ping pong.
Chris Walken can do anything, buddy.
Ping pong.
I feel like I saw parts of this movie on cable. Balls of Fury, 2007 Balls of Fury. So that's a crazy talented cast. Yeah. And I believe it's one of the only comedies we'll ever talk about with its own Wii and Nintendo DS ping pong game. That I tried to look. I don't think it has any of the voice cast in it. Like, Walken is on the cover of the Wii game in his Fu Manchu outfit. But yeah, an uproarious comedy. I think is it from Tom Lennon and Robert Ben Gurion?
I think so, yeah.
Oh,
the State Fellas.
That's disappointing to me.
Yeah.
We need a comedy for this week.
Yeah, but it's like, it's got like hints of brat packiness to it. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm surprised it isn't like Balls of Fury, the Bill Jimmy story or whatever, just to make it more like Talladega Nights, but for ping pong. I don't know.
But I feel like the star is Dan Fogler.
Yeah. Yes, Dan Fogler, also featuring Maggie Q, George Lopez, James Hong, Terry Crews, Robert Patrick, Diedrich Bader, Aisha Tyler, Tom Lennon, and the Toby Huss. And the Bumblebee girl from the Blind Melon video.
I love all of these people,
exactly.
Except I don't know who Dan Fogler is, but I remember seeing these ads feeling like, Who are you?
He was
usually
like a schlubby sidekick to other comedic actors.
When you can't afford Jack Black, you get
Dan
Fogler.
Yeah, that's exactly the impression I got.
And he has a prominent role in the Fantastic Beasts series. I think
he was great in that, actually.
Yeah, he's really good. But it's like, it took a while for him to finally get that like mainstream appeal.
Yeah, because it looked like he's been completely overshadowed. Like the same way we lost Ving Rhames the second we were introduced to Michael Clark Duncan. We lost Dan Fogler the second we were introduced to Josh Gad.
Yes,
sorry.
Exactly.
Sorry, guys.
We only have room for one of
you.
You're
a better version of that. But that's Balls of Fury. Please enjoy the Wii game. Hopefully we won't have to stream that on our YouTube channel.
The reviews are so bad.
We also have Death Sentence. Kevin Bacon and John Goodman.
Kevin Bacon's son gets killed, and Kevin Bacon wants to go kill the guy that killed his son.
That is the most straight to HBO Eric Roberts movie title I've ever fucking heard in my entire life.
John Goodman the killer? Or
no. John Goodman's like
the fat Southern sheriff?
No, he's he's the fat gun store guy.
Okay.
There you go.
But the big movie, and I want to talk about it so much. Number one at the box office. Rob Zombie's Halloween.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Which I had neglected to see up until before this recording, which I just wanted to do my due diligence.
Thank you. I didn't watch it.
I can't pretend to be the biggest Halloween fan, but the original Halloween, I've watched pretty much every Halloween for the last 4 years. It's a garage band masterpiece by John Carpenter, scoring, writing, shooting, directing. Great fucking film. It holds up really, really well. Brutally simple. Quick, well-paced, it's awesome. And it's beloved for a reason. I grew up around horror fans. None of us were really that big into Halloween. I haven't seen Halloween. I've seen Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, the unrelated, non-Michael Myers movie, more than I've never seen, more than I've seen Halloween 2, and I've never seen 4, 5, or maybe 6. I can't remember. Of course, I've seen, as Henry called it, Halloween Water, H2O, and I believe the part 8 that's in there. This is the 9th movie in the Halloween sequence, and it's disappointing for a kabillion reasons. One, its reception hurt Rob Zombie's legacy, who was kind of just getting started making, in my opinion, really fucking cool horror movies. Devil's Rejects is House of the Thousand Corpses is really good. Devil's Rejects is fucking great. And this is his third film, going back to revisit one of his favorite properties, John Carpenter's Halloween, and it is fucking terrible. Terrible. You might remember why, but I assure you it's worse than you can imagine. I remember reading they spend too much time on Michael Myers' backstory.
Yeah.
And in my head, it was like the same idiocy I saw in the awful Willy Wonka remake, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory from Tim Burton, where we need to introduce Christopher Lee's
issues.
Yeah, Willy Wonka's dentist father, played by Christopher Lee. How dare you make that one of his last roles, Tim Burton? I hated that, but it was brief. The movie starts out with a young kid, 10-year-old, killing his family and mother's boyfriend, and we remain with this child for 45 minutes.
Whoa.
45 minutes. The original movie opens up with an unseen person escaping a mental asylum. We're told he's dangerous, and then we're introduced to Jamie Lee Curtis's Laurie Strode. And the tension starts from there. The stalking, the little appearances by Michael Myers. No origin, no backstory needed, because there's, of course, a reveal that's kind of important at the end. This 40 fucking minutes. 40 minutes of backstory. It's the most fan fiction fucking thing I've ever seen on film. And it's a different fucking film. And then about over an hour into the 2-hour movie, Michael Myers in a mask appears. And then the ending is just like this abrupt sequence of almost shot-for-shot remakes of the original Halloween. So the tone in the movie is the opening hour is Malcolm McDowell talking to a disturbed child for 45 fucking minutes.
Wow.
Can you imagine a Freddy Krueger or Jason movie that opens with 40 minutes of Jason and Freddy as a child?
Wow.
It's disgusting. And it's how it got that far and how it got made like that is fucking baffling. And people rightfully hate this fucking movie. And like just tonally. The first thing is like a psychiatric drama. And then it turns into this hack and slash fest that Halloween is known for, which you build up to, but not this fucking long. It was excruciating because that part is technically well done, but it belongs in a different genre of film, not a Halloween movie, and it's terrible. And Rob Zombie got another shot at Halloween 2, which I will definitely not fucking see after this one. I hear it's even fucking worse.
Wow.
But this is really bad, and I thought Rob Zombie had a real promising career making cool horror movies and fucked it up 10 years ago this week with a Halloween remake. And I mean, I'm not against remakes. Horror movies are meant to be remade, meant to be sequelized.
Yeah, but
I'm down
none
with
of them
that.
Really took.
They
I
don't
mean,
take.
They did a Friday the 13th remake. That didn't work. They did a Nightmare on Elm Street remake, and that didn't work.
Yeah, they usually take because they're either executed well in a new way or a new concept. You can't remake a new concept. That's not going to work. And we've seen a bunch of other really cool movies, horror movies pop up. It Follows. Fuck, I'm forgetting one I saw recently. The Witch, just... That's new. That's fresh. We haven't seen that before. Neat. And those movies do really well. I do wish they'd kind of stop remaking the horror. Just no origin stories. How about that? Because it's getting yet another reboot as we speak for the 11th Halloween film.
I mean, I know they keep doing this because of name recognition, but there's no reason that you can't make a horror movie where, you know, it's about teenagers going up against... Vason Jorhees, you know, he's just slightly different.
But that
he does something. I guess I'll give, like, as much as I hate to, but like Jeepers Creepers at least did something different, and it's still just monster eat people.
Take Jason Voorhees, see him as a kid and give him 100 pages of dialogue. Like, could you imagine how not
weird.
Down you'd be with that idea? I don't know how it got this far because the script leaked. Everybody hated it. They said the studio assured people there was rewrites on it. There wasn't. It's not. It is so not good. It's not even that it's disrespectful to 1978's Halloween, because you can do a different thing. But it's just not. It was pointless. It was fucking pointless. It was a fan writing his own fan fiction about who Michael Myers might have been in the insane asylum. And that's it's not compelling in any way whatsoever. Bummed out by that. But if you like more, I know we did a Laser Time episode on LaserTimePodcast.com last year, where we counted up who had the highest body count. And Michael Myers was kind of up there due to his, like, 10 film appearances. But, yes, the Jamie Lee Curtis character doesn't get introduced until, like, an hour into the movie.
What the hell?
It's absolutely insane. And, of course, the reveal is that was your brother, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you should know that by now. But the original Halloween, you motherfuckers who claim to love Stranger Things, I don't have a lot of vivid memories of 1982, but 1978 looks just like it. It's a really, really fun movie, and to me, evocative of a childhood Halloween. And I encourage you all to check out the original. It's really fun and really tight and really well done. But let me stop bitching and we can move on to TV.
Which has another forgettable movie. Megasnake aired on Sci-Fi.
Okay.
Kind of a dead week for TV just in general. But I thought this was interesting because it also ties into another very 2007 thing. The winner of Stan Lee's Who Wants to Be a Superhero was supposed to have a starring role in this movie, but they ended up just cutting it down to a quick appearance.
So this was like the winner got to bring a superhero into this movie? Because I feel like every time there's like a televised talent competition, that I never see the result
like
of this.
Like every year it'd be like, the winner of Last Comic Standing gets an NBC contract.
Who the fuck is this guy?
I never saw that fan on NBC again.
He's famous for winning Last Comic Standing. I've never seen anything else he's done. I can name like three American Idol people I've ever seen after they win a fucking season-long competition.
I do have a clip of the trailer, though.
Oh, boy.
It is the body he eats. But it is the fear he devours.
Mega Snake.
Do not fear the heart of the snake.
It leads me to believe that sci-fi intentionally shitty horror movie thing has been happening for a lot longer than
now.
I thought.
Oh, yeah. At least.
The Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus.
We just had
Sharknado
5.
And
also this week on August 31st, 2007...
What?
Tak and the Power of Juju debuted on Cartoon Network 4 years after the GameCube game released and nobody bought it.
Yeah.
So I don't know like why that would even happen.
I want to say if it was tangled in production for that long.
Because it's a CGI show.
But Tak and the Power of... Tak the game character, it reminds me of like... Wow, that's one. Why is this game available in a grocery store? It was that type of game, and for to get a show 4 years later is bizarre.
It only lasted like a season, so whatever.
But this is one of the weirdest times ever for games.
Speaking
we'll
of games, I'm just going to go through this list of video games because they're all so different.
I want to talk about them.
A lot of them are pretty notable.
Working in the games industry in this year, this first one is like a thorn in your side. Yeah, this is one of the best-selling games of the year.
Yeah, Carnival Games came out on the Nintendo DS and the Nintendo Wii. It's one of the best-selling third-party Wii games ever. Yeah. I think it kind of gave a lot of other third-party companies...
Let's make a minigame collection.
Yeah, let's make a game for the Wii because it's set like this Carnival Games game is selling super well. Our game should sell super well too. No, there's only like a handful of third-party games.
Carnival Games got on real early.
Yeah.
And it became like a phenomenon. They wouldn't stop, and that awful barbershop-looking derby mustache dude was like the most irritating, boring-looking icon I could think gaming had that year. That was it was for us. It was fucking everywhere.
Yeah.
Really obnoxious.
But never played it. Kind of have no desire to do
you mean
that.
You ever sawed a log in a Wii game?
No.
What did Brett call it? Flipping pancakes and stabbing ghosts. That's all you can do.
You know what's cheaper than buying Carnival games?
Going to
the
carnival
and playing some games, and you can win a stuffed animal.
Winning something real.
Speaking of animals, Blue Dragon
came
out on the Xbox 360. Mm-hmm. This was a Xbox 360 exclusive JRPG with
Mistwalker.
Yes, Mistwalker was the developer, and character design was from Dragon Ball's Akira Toriyama. Really cutesy. Like one of the first big efforts of the Xbox 360 to like get JRPGs and kind of make headway in Japan, which they never really did.
Diana, you don't know, Xbox broke into the video game stream and it did pretty well for itself,
especially in Europe, but not in Japan.
In Japan, nobody bit, so they bent over backwards to try and finance kind of obtuse. Yeah. Really giant and expensive RPGs to get the Japanese audience interested in the Xbox brand, and it never took.
Yeah.
It never took, and I remember this also being an argument in that the PS3 had released, and its big controversy was having a Blu-ray drive in it and made it cost $600.
Yeah.
But it also could have fit a game this big with this many cutscenes on one disc. This is, I think, the only three-disc Xbox game I own.
Wow.
Because that was something the PS3 could tout. And speaking of PS3, more Japanese love.
Warhawk came out on PlayStation 3.
I was going to say Dynasty Warriors Gundam.
I think that was on both. It may have been both. Was it just PS3? I don't know.
Early on in the PS3's launch,
So it's basically exactly what the title says, which is the action of Dynasty Warriors where you're fighting dozens of enemies on screen at the same time, but now it's with Gundam, so you're fighting dozens of robots at the same time.
Yeah, I think when Diana and my mother think of what video games are, they think of Dynasty Warriors.
But I will say...
Sword, indiscriminate slashes, kill everything, die.
The one thing that will make me want to play a Dynasty Warriors game is... If you get rid of the Dynasty Warriors.
Yeah. New IP.
Like, you put Gundam in there.
Zelda.
I'm interested. You put Zelda in there. I'm interested. Yeah. You put Dragon here. Dragon Heroes in there. I'm interested. Oh, yeah. Also, a pair of PS3 exclusives this week. Warhawk, which was the sequel to the PS1 launch game
that we all thought we wanted.
Well, if we had gotten it the way it should have been, then we might have liked it. But it was a multiplayer only game.
Well, that was a huge slander back then. Like, giving a multiplayer only game.
But Warhawk was also, it had a campaign back in the day.
It had only a campaign.
Yeah, which was cutscenes. I think in 2007, it was kind of criminal to do a multiplayer-only game. So to not have a single-player campaign that could at least get people to, like, you know, the single-player campaign is what, makes you good at multiplayer because you learn all the tricks. And I would love to play, like, I loved Warhawk back in the day on PS1. Never really played on PS3 because I was like, I'm not going to jump right into multiplayer. I don't like multiplayer that much.
Yeah, I don't want to get murdered before I can figure out where my throttle button is.
So it took them like 11, 12 years to make a sequel to a
game. It was also, I think, general apathy. Like, it came out at PS1 launch, and I think Sony probably just thought, well, people don't really love this game. They just had no other choice.
Not unlike Hamburger Hill.
Yeah.
When I got my PlayStation late in the game, it was the cheapest, well-reviewed exclusive I could afford.
Yeah.
So I immediately got it and played the shit
out of it. It was also, I believe, from the same... I think it was the same developer as Twisted Metal, and it was like, well, they got bigger First Fry 2.
Jet Moto. I'm trying to remember the logo.
Yeah, with single track. Also on PS3 this week, Lair...
Why can't we get dragon riding
games
right? Which
was a six-axis controlled flying sim, dragon flying sim, which eventually had standard controls patched in, but that was the big failing of this game, is that the six-axis controller, which a last-minute addition by many accounts, a last-minute addition to the PS3 controller, was that you could tilt the controller and it would approximate, like, you know, tilting motions.
It worked better than the Wii.
Yeah, but also, like, because it was introduced so late, like, launch games didn't really use it. It took a while for it to be introduced into games. And Lair, which looked really good, kind of reminds me of Crimson Dragon, which was...
Factor 5.
But, like, if you want... Like, it would be awesome to have a fun game where you fly around as a dragon, but let us use standard controls that we're used to for years. In this case, they're like, no, just tilt your controller around all the time and don't press anything on it, and just, that's how you fly the dragon.
Do you not have the option? You can't just...
It launched without the option.
Yeah, it was eventually patched in, but... Yeah, like Crimson.
I have the choice.
Yeah, yeah. Happened later with the. I mean, Microsoft made the same mistake with Crimson Dragon for a while. That was supposed to be Kinect only. And then they're like, let's put controls.
It's already bad enough.
Yeah, let's put controls in here. Wild Arms 5 also out this week. This is sequel to the Western, not Western RPG in that it's made in America. A Western RPG in the that's about the Wild West. Okay. Wild Arms 1 is one of my favorite games. It's got a great soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
And it's super fun. It's got both, Western elements, gunslinging, but also giant robots. So
the
best
title,
of both
though, just, I Wild mean, Arms. Wild Arms, that's why I always have bruises on my elbows. Because I'm always walking around, I don't know where my arms are, and I smack into things.
Spaghetti limbs.
Yep. I've been told by my girlfriend I have Wild Arms at night, and I need to get some sort of medication for that. And the big game of this week, at least, I mean, it probably didn't sell as well as Carnival Games, but the big game, one I reviewed, is Metroid Prime 3 Corruption.
But you list this as the most recent Metroid Prime game.
Most recent Metroid Prime game, and also you can make the case that it's the last good Metroid game. Metroid Prime 4 was just announced at E3. We're going to get a new Metroid game in a month on the 3DS, which hopefully will be good. But yes,
Prime is 2019.
Yeah,
bound.
That's like I would guess it's 2019 because they announced it at E3 2017 with just an image of the logo, no gameplay. So it's probably early in development. But yeah, Metroid Prime 3 Corruption, the sequel to the two previous GameCube games that were really good. There was a little bit of worry because it was put on the Wii, which I mean, we just talked about the failings of Lair, where it's like, can I just have standard controls here? Metroid Prime 3 Corruption, you do have to use the pointer.
Yeah, and stylus, and touchscreen.
Yeah, yeah. This is on the Wii.
My bad.
So yeah, you're moving.
Yes,
you're moving Samus with a thumbstick, but you're aiming with the Wii remote. But it worked well.
I think it's the only first person shooter that worked well with the Wii nunchuck and Wii remote controls. I can't believe I just said it correctly. Like they trained me to.
Yeah,
it's a Wiimote. We know it.
I think I gave it like a 7.5 or an 8. I think it's not quite at the level of Metroid Prime and Metroid Prime 2, which are like two of my favorite Metroid games. Like it's Super Metroid and then those two games. And then Metroid Prime Corruption is also, it's really good. You can actually get it as part of the Metroid Prime trilogy.
Really put that out again for Switch.
And it's on the Wii U. I know you can do that. You can download the Wii version on Wii U.
I know,
so.
But there's like a widescreen up-res version.
But
it's perfect for
Switch. I think the problem is that it still uses
It still requires
the
Wii remote.
Yeah, like, because if you download this on your Wii U, you still got to use your Wii thumbstick and Wii remote to play Metroid Prime 3. Because they had to scale everything. Like enemies are a little bit more easily defeated because you have to use this similar complex aiming system. But it got good reviews. One of the more well received Wii games, it's like this and Smash Brothers and Mario Sunshine.
But that concludes the show. But yes, we go out with a comment because we started a comment show where we do a 30-20-10 Patreon exclusive show on patreon.com/lasertime that incorporates all your feedback. Because I assure you, your anecdotes are funnier than ours, and you sometimes come to bat for shit either we slam or don't know anything about. I do love having equal voices on here. And we have one from Aimbot Master, who just sent us a weirdo care package. I'm just going to try and give this to you, Dave. The Resident Evil Nemesis novelization.
I read this. played this game like 2 years ago.
In an X-Men novel.
Ah.
No pictures. Yeah. Who asked for that? A King Kong flip book and a TV Guide anniversary issue. Thank you, Aimbot Master.
For The Simpsons.
But Aimbot Master pointed out a news story that we missed, saying that a sad shout-out to the 30 years ago, probably the most notable thing to happen in my town of Romulus, Michigan?
Romulus, Michigan.
A plane crashed during takeoff from an airport, killing everyone on board except one little girl.
Oh, my God.
It was the second deadliest aviation accident at the time in the United States. Northwest Airlines Flight 255 crashed shortly after takeoff from Detroit Metropolitan Airport on August 16, 1987, at about 8:46 p.m., killing all six crew members and 148 of its 149 passengers, along with two people on the ground. The sole survivor was a four-year-old girl, Cecilia Sishan, who sustained serious injuries.
Wow.
Jesus Christ.
The Harry Potter of that flight.
It's my understanding that most plane crashes
kill everybody.
Well, take place during landings and takeoffs.
Oh yeah.
You don't usually fall out of the sky. Yeah. I'm surprised that shit like that hasn't happened since. But sorry about that, Aimbot. And you can find we'll read off more of those comments in our bonus show with more clips. Really fun. Patreon.com/LaserTime. It's how we live. Find out more about our shows on LaserTimePodcast.com. We have LaserTime, a show I've mentioned several times. Mm-hmm. We had a recent episode about the most controversial songs and the artists who made them. That was really fun. And
Weird censorship.
Censorship was great.
All about farts. If you like this show, but you want something more topic-based, it's a lot like that with a lot of the same people. It's really fun. Give it an hour. I swear you'll find an episode you like. But you can, and also there you can find Talking Simpsons. We don't talk about The Simpsons that much because we have an entire show that breaks down every single episode reference with sound clips and occasional interviews from the people who made The Simpsons, TalkingSimpsons.com or Patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. With our buddies Bob and Henry Gilbert. I made it sound like they're brothers. Bob Mackey of Retronauts fame. And, of course, we have Video Game Apocalypse, hosted by Mr. Diana Goodman, Michael Raparez. And you can hear a lot more information about dated games and new stuff on that show every single Friday.
Yeah, once in a while, a game that we talk about here kind of inspires the VGA
episode idea. Totally. But any other plugs we've got to get out there? Diana, Listener Nerd.
On the Twitter.
And thank you for joining us on Laser Times here and there. That's been really fun.
Yeah, there have been some good ones.
Yeah, so at some point we'll have a deep quiz for Diana, see how she performs.
Ooh.
But now we got to get into the deaths.
All right, Death and Rebirth, The Cycle of Samsara. 1987, we lost Lee Marvin, who I just talked about in the classic corner. I can't believe he was only 63, because he was one of those guys that was always old, even when he wasn't old. Mm-hmm. He's just, I don't know if there's another actor I can compare him to, because he's just like, Clint Eastwood maybe, just a really fucking tough guy, you just fuck up your shit.
Painting a wagon in heaven.
Yes, he's gonna paint a wagon. And also John Huston, the director, who was 81, he made so many good movies. I don't even know where to start, except for maybe Maltese Falcon and African Queen. And Brandon Tartikoff, who's only 48. He was the NBC executive that was totally responsible for their rebirth and the must-see TV and stuff.
Was he the guy Bob Balaban was standing in for on Seinfeld?
Probably.
I'll look him up.
I know. He guest starred in an episode of Saved by the Bell.
Really?
Well, they're doing an anti-drug PSA, and they're like, well, how are we going to get this on TV? Because the anti-drug PSA guy actually was taking drugs, and we had to kick him out. And then Mr. Belling's like, don't worry, I got a friend. And then everyone's like, Brandon Tartikoff. We both went to college together, me and Mr. Belding. He ended up a principal, and I run NBC. Who's to say who's more successful?
Dead at 48 from Hodgkin's lymphoma. All right, David.
And then in 2007, we lost Miyoshi Umeki, who is the only Asian woman to win an Oscar. And for Sayonara. And she was 78. Mm-hmm. And Richard Jewell, the guy who was
perpetrator of the Atlanta
falsely accused of the Atlanta Olympic bombing.
I remember.
He passed away. He was only 44. I didn't realize that.
We have talked about it. Yeah. But now, you know what that time it is now. Yeah. Are you ready?
I am.
Are you ready? The birthday quiz.
All right, so the birthday quiz, we're going to go a little off model because usually we do one man and one woman, mm-hmm. but I found two men with the exact same birth date.
Wow. Same year?
Same day, same year.
Okay.
So we're going to start with born August 26, 1980, New York City. He's the third of seven children. 1980. His films include Rocket Gibraltar, Saved.
Macaulay Culkin.
Only the Lone... Nice
Dang
job!
It.
Macaulay Culkin. Rocket Gibraltar was a good movie. I liked
wow.
it. That's one of his first films. Predates Home Alone,
I
think.
His very first film. Yeah.
So I know the other one can't be Kieran Culkin.
No. Okay, so the exact same age. August 26, 1980, he was born in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. He's played Princes in Into the Woods and Princess Diaries 2. He's currently in the biggest movie of the summer and Wet Hot American Summer 10 years later.
Chris Pine?
Chris Pine!
Yeah! Right. With the sweep! I know my Chris's.
I haven't got to the point where he shows up on that. Dang it.
Oh, Wonder Woman. He's in Wonder Woman.
Yes. He's in Wonder Woman, the biggest movie this summer. I did not realize his maternal grandmother was also an actress and is Jewish. That means under Jewish law, both Captain Kirk's are Jews. Yay.
Take that, Nazis. We own Starfleet.
No space Nazis.
Yeah, but that we have been 302010. Thank you very much, and we will take you out with the GoldenEye title theme.
Woo!